The Takeaway is supported by Netflix original documentary series Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On, from Rashida Jones, Jill Bauer, and Ronna Gratis. The series explores sex and technology in a digital age. Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On is now streaming only on Netflix.
The Takeaway needs your help. Visit wnyc.podcastingsurvey.com and tell us a little bit about yourself and the podcasts you love in a 5-minute anonymous survey. We really appreciate your help. Knowing more about you helps us make more of the shows you enjoy. Now here's The Takeaway for Thursday, April 27th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Back from Buffalo, New York, and in the studios of WNYC today. Trying to imagine what it's like to be a White House economic advisor these days.
President Trump comes in every day and talks to the two of us about economic growth, economic prosperity, and jobs, and what are we doing to stimulate economic growth. That's how we're looking at this plan.
Economic Council Director Gary Cohn, can you imagine Donald Trump pushing you to get the economy moving, wanting results yesterday? Well, that's a lot of pressure. And yesterday was the day the White House released the long-anticipated tax proposal, a broad-brush overview, they called it, the unveilers anyway, that cuts the corporate tax rate from 35% to 15%, repeals the Obamacare tax on investment income, doubles the standard deduction. The estate tax and the alternative minimum tax, which Trump has complained about for years, would both be abolished. According to Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who is one of the unveilers, opportunity and growth is the goal.
What the president is focused on and I'm focused on is creating opportunities for the American public, and we couldn't be more excited about that. And this plan is the beginning of creating economic growth.
Treasury Secretary was on NBC's Today Show earlier. Doing the math, though, the corporate tax cut appears to inevitably lead to an increase in the federal deficit, but the White House is counting on increased economic activity producing increased income tax revenue to the Treasury. Not unheard of, but how likely these days? With us now is Douglas Holtz Aiken, who served as Congressional Budget Office Director under George W. Bush between 2003 and 2005, and is now president of the American Action Forum. Doug, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Are the conditions today the same and favorable for a kind of growth equals increased tax revenue as was the case, some say, during the Reagan years of the 1980s?
I think the case is going to be harder right now. When Ronald Reagan took office, the country was in the midst of a very deep recession, and you get rapid growth as you come out of recessions. That's not the case right now. We're essentially somewhere near full employment. There might be a little slack left. So it's true that if you have a good tax policy, you can help the economy grow more rapidly. It's not true that you'll have it for free, that the tax cuts will pay for themselves. You're going to have to figure out some base broadening to make it work.
On the question of growth, they want to bounce it from 1%, which it is now, to 3% between now and the end of the year. What do you think the likelihood of that is?
Well, I want to express my sympathies for the objective. One of the things that's really quite striking about the environment right now is that from the end of World War II to 2007, the economy grew fast enough that when, even with the arrival of the baby boom, income per person doubled roughly every 35 years. So in one working career, the standard of living could double, and I think that's why people felt the American dream was within their reach. They could, you know, buy a vacation home or send a kid to college, whatever it might be. At the current projections, the standard of living will double every 75 years, and I think people feel that, and I think the focus on having the economy grow more rapidly is 100% appropriate. It's just not very easy. And to move it by a full percentage point from 2 to 3, a 50% increase in the growth rate, is going to take concerted effort on not just tax reform, but regulatory reforms and the infrastructure programs that you've heard so much about, and sort of everything that you can do to make the economy perform better. So I'm sympathetic to the objective. I just think it's not numerically going to add up the way they think.
Well, they're certainly, you know, down with doing everything they can do to make that growth figure. But you talked about base building as a way of achieving their objective. What does that mean?
Well, you do tough things like get rid of deductions that people otherwise would like to have. It would be great. So a contrasting approach is what the House of Representatives have done. They have what they call a blueprint for tax reform, and they're working on legislation. And it has some things in it like eliminating the deductibility of interest by corporations. when you're specific about that, you know, that will raise a lot of revenue. That will help the tax rate come down to 20% in their case, not 15. But, you know, you get specific, people start throwing rocks at you. So it's hard work to do tax reform. To just walk out and say, I'd like a 15% rate for corporations, 15% for pass-throughs, we'll double the standard deduction, cut these marginal income tax rates, and it'll all be fine. That's not tax reform. That's a set of goals and objectives, perhaps, but tax reform is filling in the blanks and making it add up.
Fill in the blanks for the middle class. What needs to happen for this to be politically viable, and what needs to happen for this to be economically viable? And those appear to be two different things in this era.
I'd say that for it to be economically viable, that's the objective. Getting the economy to grow more rapidly is the single best thing that could happen to the middle class. We have seen, you know, a fairly anemic recovery from a very deep recession. We have not seen real wages adjusted for inflation, rise in any kind of sustained fashion. The middle class feels that painfully, right? Many people had a job throughout, right? The unemployment rate got to 10%, but that means that 90% of people had the job. They just haven't seen a raise for a decade, and that's hard. So getting the economy to grow more rapidly, push those wages up, allow people to live better, that's the single best thing that could happen. That's better than any government program that we could imagine. So I think the objective is the correct one. Selling it to them, having them believe that these kinds of policies will make them better off, I honestly think there's only one person who can make that sale, and that's the president of the United States. At least to my eye, Donald Trump was elected president with the single mandate, make this economy work better. And his election carried with him a majority of Republicans in the House, a majority of Republicans in the Senate. So I think they will all be evaluated in the end on whether the economy is better than when they arrived. And so the stakes are quite high.
Well, I want to talk about the deficit, but since you mentioned the sort of salesman in chief here, you know, let's take a look at the ability of Donald Trump to actually sell this plan. Is it affected by the fact that getting rid of the alternative minimum tax and the estate tax would probably benefit Trump's assets as much as anyone in the United States, according to, you know, partial data obtained by some journalists? The Trump tax bill of $38 million on $150 million in 2005, would, without the alternative minimum tax, he would have actually paid just $7.5 million, taking all of his deductions, and that would have been a rate of 4%. Get rid of the alternative minimum tax, and you know, that's worth tens of millions to Donald Trump. Now, it's also true that, you know, tax reform benefits all presidents if they're in those top tax brackets. What do you make of Trump's apparent standing to benefit here?
I think two things. First, if it is portrayed or perceived, more importantly, by voters as entirely self-serving, it will fail. That's not the route to successful tax reform. The reality of tax reform, broadly defined to be lower the rates, broaden the base, you know, get the tax system out of micromanaging decisions, that strategy has always involved winners and losers, and they can be vociferous. And tax reform has not happened for 31 years, in part because Congress has embarked on tax reform efforts in the past. And as they, you know, create winners and losers, typically in the business community, when members go home to their districts or senators go home to their states, they hear from those guys. They, you know, this is a full contact sport we're entering into here. There's right. No doubt about it.
So the Tax Foundation says that the corporate tax rate alone, mentioned in the unveiling yesterday, you know, loses $2 trillion over the next 10 years, and that will undoubtedly increase the deficit. Now, is this politically viable because the GOP is divided on whether to deal with the deficit or not?
I think real tax reform has to be permanent. And for that reason, I think it has to be revenue neutral. You can't have these increases in the deficit. It's true that the growth will give you more revenue, and I think that everyone should acknowledge that and build that into the planning on a tax reform. But you're not going to get a dollar of additional revenue from the growth for every dollar tax cut. You're going to get about 25 to 35 cents at best, and you're going to have to figure out where the other 65 to 75 cents are going to come from.
We've got to go. I've got to do an ultrasound here of your gut, Douglas Holtzakin. when you saw this yesterday, did you say, all right, well, maybe they can actually pull it off? Or did you go, I'm glad I'm far away from this?
So I had three reactions to it. Number one, it did not take off the table anything that's been proposed in the House and the Senate. So it didn't stop progress. I was grateful for that. It was a real possibility the whole thing could have died right in that moment. Second thing I thought was, well, you know, they're being pretty aggressive on the corporate rate. They're being pretty aggressive on the pass-throughs. I'm not sure that's realistic. And then the third thing, and the one that I'm most concerned about is, oh, they're selling this as easy, right? We just can do all this stuff and growth will take care of it. That's just not true.
Great talking to you. Douglas Holtz-Eakin is the president of the American Action Forum and former Congressional Budget Office director under George W. Bush between 2003 and 2005. Thanks so much, Doug.
Thank you.
You can call it Battle of the Bands or Paul Ryan's Hope. Freedom Caucus versus the Tuesday Group. I have all their albums. Both groups need to compromise for there to be a deal in the House on a new health care package. We may be there. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent Todd Zwillick is here. So, Todd, has the music stopped?
It hasn't yet. You know, you described it right, John. The conservatives in the Freedom Caucus trying to strike a deal with the Tuesday group, that's essential. The right wing and the moderates need to reach agreement within the Republican conference here to get an Obama repeal and replace that's been promised. Here's what the amendment looks like it does. It's going to give states the option to opt out of a lot of insurance mandates, important ones under Obamacare, and things called essential health benefits. Let me deal with those two things. First of all, essential health benefits, insurance companies under Obamacare in the individual market have to cover things like emergency care, like maternity care, prenatal care, pediatrics, lab services. This deal would give states the option to opt out of those mandates, cover some, not others. In addition, you know, John, one of the most important parts of this whole thing, and you know this, pre-existing conditions, right? The one thing in Obamacare that everybody loves, guaranteed coverage. They can't deny you because you have a history of diabetes or cancer or a broken arm or something like that. Well, under this deal, you still have guaranteed access to insurance if you have a pre-existing condition. But here's the rub. Insurance companies would be able to charge anything they want for that access if your governor opts out. That's the option there, to give states the option to opt out. Now, is this deal, first of all, going to get to the floor for a vote? Maybe. The language is out. There could be a vote as soon as Saturday if Paul Ryan and leadership can round up the votes for a quick vote here. Or it could go into next week or not at all. We don't know. Here's Tom Cole. He's been on the show before. He speaks for leadership. He's from Oklahoma. He says things are coming along.
You know, we obviously had problems at both ends of our conference. And it looks like the you know, in the intervening break, those differences have narrowed. That's good.
Well, that's a sound of compromise, but are they really going to get there?
That's a sound of compromise in the House, and right. I'm gonna open a new movie that you've seen before. This then goes to the Senate, where nobody I talked to last night, having just seen the outlines of this new deal, was impressed at all. You remember that before the repeal plan a couple of weeks ago collapsed under its own weight in the House, there were Republicans all over the Senate laughing at this thing, saying, oh boy, are we going to open this thing up and change it when it gets here. Here is Senator Tom Tillis. He's a doctor. He's a leader on health care, even though he's a freshman. And he made it clear that the surgery's not over here.
They can't dictate what the Senate does, and we can't dictate what they do.
Is there really this division between the House and Senate, even though both are GOP?
Oh, it's gigantic. The Senate is much more moderate in its overall politics and way more moderate on health care. They have different priorities. Don't forget, senators don't react to every election the way House members do. They're not as prone to do what Donald Trump wants. They have six-year terms, and they have to live longer with the consequences. This deal is far from over.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway DC correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Confused about what's going on Capitol Hill? Consult the wise old man of the U.S. Senate. Long a bridge builder in Congress, George Mitchell of Maine defies categories of left and right, but he is passionate about decorum in the Senate in particular and Washington in general. And he kept that rule when asked about the Trump first 100 days. Success? Failure? Does Mitchell go for presidential punchlines? No way.
I stay out of the personal characteristic aspect of it. I stick with policy. But in policy, no one can rationally argue that this was a successful 100 days.
At a recent event at the Sorensen Center for International Peace and Justice, I held a conversation with the former Senate Majority Leader. He believes there is a crisis in governance in America, from the cheap shots of Saturday Night Live to the obstructionism in the House of Representatives. In the Senate from 1980 to 1995, He's seen it all and says the evident confusion of the early Trump days is not really that new. Something Americans might realize, he says, if they cooled off and focused on problem solving, not personalities.
I was Senate Majority Leader for 6 years, and I learned through painful experience to control my temper. But there are some things that got me so darn angry, I just couldn't get over it. And here's the one that got me the angriest. When we debated health care reform at that time, President Clinton proposed an expansion of the current system, health care provided by employers, an accident of history. It's a way of getting around the wage and price controls of the Second World War. That's how our system was created and built up. So the president proposed an extension of it. But every single senator on the other side who opposed it got up and said to the American people, this is government health care, and government health care is bad for you. And when they finished speaking, they'd walk out the back door, take 20 steps, and go to the office of the Senate physician, where they would be welcomed by a government nurse and examined by a government doctor. If it's good enough for them, why is it so bad for the American people? What kind of argument is that? And I blame us for that. We have not done a good job at making our case to the American people. We have let the other side make arguments that I believe are historically inaccurate, that don't describe what the true needs are of the American people and don't really meet those needs in a substantial way.
Given that healthcare is the source of so much anxiety in America, I'm wondering if this campaign represents a breakdown of the party system in that people aren't voting for policies, they're voting for make me feel better about my fear, reduce my fear. And when you have that kind of a situation on both sides, you've lost the thread that keeps the electorate connected to policy and what sort of government service is all about. And I don't see how we regain that.
I don't disagree with you, but I don't think that's new. And I don't think it's the first time that a president promised things that he can't deliver on. President Wilson campaigned on a promise to keep America out of the First World War. And as soon as he took office, he started to figure out how do we get in. That's the reality of life. What you say at one time, you may genuinely believe, but circumstances dictate a different result. And remember, keep two of Churchill's maxims in mind. Democracy is the worst possible form of government, except for anything else human beings right. have tried. And secondly, democracy guarantees a fair process, not a good result.
Evaluating the first 100 days of the Trump administration, you have memory of the Newt Gingrich contract with America. And you also have memory of the remarkable success that Lyndon Johnson had in the White House, having had your job as majority leader in the days after the Kennedy assassination, when an extraordinary number of big radical changes in American legislation and in involving social justice took place. What did Johnson have at his disposal, and what was going on in the American government that made those changes that we can't imagine today possible?
First, Johnson benefited from the fact that there was a sense of comity in the Senate, a sense of personal restraint that has since completely disappeared. And it is best illustrated in two figures. In his entire tenure as Senate Majority Leader, Lyndon Johnson confronted two filibusters. In my last 2 years as Senate Majority Leader, I confronted 75 filibusters.
Wow.
In his tenure as Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid confronted over 400 filibusters. So that's the first point. The second point is Johnson skillfully accumulated power in the person of the Majority Leader that did not previously exist. And he then proceeded to abuse that power to the degree that when he left office, the Senate stripped the majority leader of the personal powers that he had accumulated so that no future Senate majority leader would ever again abuse those powers as he had done. But life is imperfect. Sometimes you do the right thing and the wrong result occurs. Sometimes you do the wrong thing and you produce a good result. I'll give you one example to make my point. I was the Senate majority leader when President Bush nominated Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. We had the votes to defeat him, 52-48. And I had several Democratic senators come to me and request that as Majority Leader, I organize a filibuster to prevent Clarence Thomas from becoming Supreme Court Justice. I declined. The use of the filibuster in opposition to Supreme Court nominees began in the Morton era when Lyndon Johnson nominated Abe Fortas from associate to Chief Justice. The Republicans threatened a filibuster. He was not confirmed. There was then a downward spiral because the fact is, in all conflict, military, political, or otherwise, once a weapon comes into existence, it is rapidly disseminated to all sides. And I said to my Democrat colleagues, I'm not going to do it because it's not the right thing to do, in the hope that this will reverse the downward spiral in which we are engaged. We did it. He was confirmed, and we had no effect on the downward spiral. As soon as the Republicans were in the reverse position, they blocked even more nominees. When Democrats were in the opposite position, they did their best at obstructionism, and it's now reached the point that we've seen. So aspire to do the right thing, but be realistic enough to recognize that doing the right thing does not always produce the right result.
That was former Senator from Maine, George Mitchell, in a conversation at the Sorenson Center for International Peace and Justice at CUNY Law, where he's a scholar in residence. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. For millions of Americans, health care, particularly public health, has meant tracking the opioid crisis. It's a problem virtually everywhere among middle classes and economically disadvantaged whites. In West Virginia, the sluggish economy and the loss of the coal industry have created a spiral of hopelessness that has led to a growth in drug addiction rates in the state. When people in Appalachia think health care reform, many look to how high of a priority the government gives addiction treatment. Dave Mistich is managing editor of 100 Days in Appalachia. The project is a collaboration between West Virginia Public Broadcasting, West Virginia University's Reed College of Media, and the Daily Yonder. Mistich says this center of Trump support has learned to be patient.
Early on, there were a lot of people here that said, well, you know, he can turn it around in a month or 2 months or this first 100 days. Other people, I think, are a little bit more realistic about that. And I think that there are some people, very few people at least, that believe that Trump hasn't been able to deliver on those promises as of now.
So how is the priority list made among the people that you speak with? There was some talk about the opioid epidemic among some of the candidates. Not so much with Trump, but he certainly brought it up. Is that top of the line for many, many people?
I would say so. I mean, you know, as a lot of people have realized that Appalachia was ground zero for that particular issue, a lot of programs for addiction treatment are tied to the Affordable Care Act. And therefore, I think there's a lot of people concerned that a lot of those treatment programs might go away. You know, there's a whole slew of other things at play. I think one, first and foremost, is the economy, bringing jobs to Appalachia. In detailing his sort of lean budget, so to speak, there were proposed cuts to things like the Appalachian Regional Commission and programs like AmeriCorps Vista. You know, those programs, particularly the Appalachian Regional Commission, provide all sorts of types of jobs. So I think the biggest concern mostly is the economy. Of course, you know, with that comes sort of issues related to the opioid epidemic, at least to some degree.
How about people in this region broken down along the lines of ideology or moral issues? I mean, we heard a lot of rhetoric coming from Trump that seemed to be linked to intolerance and trends of racial tension. Do people reject that or do they embrace it?
Well, you know, I think that there is certainly an undercurrent to that. Coming up this weekend on day 100 of Trump's presidency, there is a rally for white working families that's going to be hosted by the Traditionalist Workers Party. And there's a big constituency of opposition to that, I should point out. There's a lot of folks in southern West Virginia and on the western part of the state that are actually planning to go and counter protest of that rally. At this point, no one really knows exactly what's going to happen on Saturday. But I will say that the counter protest movement has been very vocal in trying to stop or shut this thing down or at least make a presence in some regard.
You know, a question to ask in every community is, what do people need to know about your place in America right now that's different from what the media might be characterizing these people, your people, as? What would you say if you were asked, what do people need to know about the people of Appalachia?
this place is very nuanced. And, you know, you look at a lot of national media portrayals of West Virginia and Appalachia, and you see pictures of a trailer park or pictures of a rusted out building or a fallen down barn. I think one of the things that people in Appalachia really want the rest of the world to know is that there is so much more cultural and economic diversity here that really doesn't show up in a lot of places. I think the sort of simplest stories, obviously, are the ones that get told. West Virginia and Appalachia are much more nuanced, and there are people here that have struggled, sure, but there are people here doing a lot of different things that have not gotten the attention from the government and not gotten the attention from the media, for sure.
Dave Mistich is managing editor of 100 Days in Appalachia. The project is a collaboration between West Virginia Public Broadcasting, West Virginia University's Reed College of Media, and The Daily Yonder. Taking a look at those nuances is his assignment. Dave, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On, a Netflix original documentary series from Rashida Jones, Jill Bauer, and Ronna Gratis, the women who brought you the critically acclaimed film Hot Girls Wanted. The series explores the intersection of sex and technology in a digital age and covers six true stories inside a world that is faking it. A 2017 Sundance Film Festival official selection, Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On is now streaming only on Netflix.
Question: is the persistent, long-standing Israel-Palestine tension about to burst out into the open? Thousands of Palestinians have taken to the streets in recent days in support of a mass hunger strike by Palestinian prisoners currently held in Israeli prisons. It's the second week of the strike of about 1,500 prisoners led by Marwan Barghouti, who's been in captivity for 15 years, is seen as a potential successor to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. She covers the region for the George Mitchell Institute for Global Peace, Security, and Justice at Queen's University, Belfast. Julie Norman is a research fellow and director of education there and has just ended a month-long investigation inside Israel and Palestine. Julie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So is the tension building, and what are the specific demands of the hunger strikers here?
Yeah, so the hunger strikers have a number of demands. The most prominent is the issue of family visitation. Prisoners are supposed to have two visits a month. That was reduced to once a month last summer. In addition to that, many prisoners' families aren't able to access the prisons because they need special permits to travel to Israel. So family visitation is a huge issue for the prisoners, as is access to phone lines to be able to call their families from the prisons. Other demands include better medical care, better treatment during transfer, an end to solitary confinement, and an end to administrative detention or detention without charge or trial.
Is Israel responding to the strikes with negotiations, with a crackdown? What's happening?
So right now, inside the prisons, there's an attempt to try and stop the strike through different methods. One is through transferring some of the leaders of the strike to isolated areas, rolling back or prohibiting visits from family, and also blocking access to lawyers. So all of these are seen as methods to try and break the strike. There's not any negotiations yet that are public anyway, but there have been negotiations in the past when similar strikes have happened. Outside of the prisons, there has been an attempt to crack down on the protests and demonstrations, which, as you noted, have been happening daily in cities and villages and camps all across the West Bank and Gaza in support of the prisoners.
How long has this strike been going on? And what's the track record of hunger strikes as a political weapon in getting Israel to meet particular demands?
Yeah, so this strike has been going on for about 10 days now. It started on Monday of last week. The trajectory of strikes varies. There's a long history of hunger strikes in Palestine, some of which were more successful than others, especially those in the 70s and 80s. In more recent years, the strikes have not been as successful. There's often a decision made to kind of agree to reinstate some of the rights that were rolled back during the strike, but not to grant additional demands. Adding to this is the fact that Israel reauthorized the use of force feeding in 2015 that had been ceased since the 80s. So if the strike does get to a more severe point, that tactic, as has been used in Guantanamo and elsewhere, will probably be used to break the strike.
How does this dispute and the success of this hunger strike, if indeed it is successful, stir the political situation among Palestinians regarding Mahmoud Abbas and the longstanding confusion at the top of the Palestinian Authority.
Yeah, so this is an important part of the strike. The strike is obviously directed towards Israel, but it's also putting pressure on the Palestinian Authority as well. The PA has been charged, you know, by Marwan Barghouti in particular, for coordinating with Israel in its own security apparatuses. So one thing the strike is trying to do is bring attention to that, pressure the PA to rethink their own policies, and also to augment Barghouti's standings as well within Fatah and within the Palestinian Authority more broadly.
Where do you think this is headed?
Well, when you asked about the demand and the success, I think one thing that's important to note is there's different ways to assess success in a hunger strike. And this strike already is bringing attention to the issue of imprisonment in Palestine. It's mobilizing people all across the West Bank and Gaza from all political parties, not just Fatah, also from PFLP, DFLP, Hamas. So this is really already having an effect in terms of bringing people out around a common cause.
Speaking to us from Beirut, Julie Norman is Research Fellow and Director of Education at the George Mitchell Institute for Global Peace, Security, and Justice. Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks a lot.
In this hemisphere, it's hard to see how much worse things can get for Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro. But it's the people of Venezuela who are feeling the brunt of hyperinflation and essentially an economic shutdown. Thousands of people in the streets every day demanding new elections, protesting shortages. A diplomatic effort from the Washington-based Organization of American States has only produced a threat from the Caracas government to leave the oldest alliance in this hemisphere. On a rare home leave, Hannah Dreyer, Venezuela correspondent for the Associated Press, spoke to us about the growing intensity of a nation crumbling before her eyes.
So the economic crisis and the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela, it's really hard to see how that can get worse. It's still getting incrementally worse, but the new thing in Venezuela right now is that we've had a month of deadly protests. So it was already a country with food shortages, medical shortages, and now every day there are people, sometimes tens of thousands of people in the streets. And they're getting into these violent clashes with police and government supporters, and at least 29 of them have died. And that's really prompting other governments in the region to stand up and say, this is too much, we're not going to just sit by anymore, as Venezuela just spirals into chaos. And so those governments are getting together at a regional pro-democracy group called the Organization of American States. And they're addressing the situation in Venezuela. It's a little vague. They're diplomats. But this has enraged the Venezuelan government. And just yesterday, the foreign minister said that the country was going to be pulling out of this group.
The OAS in Washington, you know, has a longstanding record of attempting to negotiate peace and democracy in the Western Hemisphere, but not recently. I mean, the OAS hasn't done anything recently. Is Venezuela already past the ability of the international community to have an impact on it?
Well, what's interesting to me is that Venezuela, for a long time under Hugo Chavez, was trying to position itself as the leader of this kind of group. They were saying, we are a progressive government in this region. We have a lot of oil money. Things are going really well for us. And we're going to make allies and kind of dominate these different regional trade groups and diplomatic groups. So now to have Venezuela just pulling out is a huge change. It kind of shows how far things have fallen. But the OAS doesn't have a ton of power. Really, the worst they can do is kick Venezuela out. And Venezuela basically just pulled a you can't fire me, I quit move.
Right. What's it like to cover these huge demonstrations? I know you spend some time on the streets as this chaos unfolds before you. What is that like?
It's one of the most dramatic things I've seen in 3 years in Venezuela. We had a big bloody protest movement in 2014, but that was really young kids in the streets setting garbage on fire and building these barricades. What I'm seeing now is a lot of older people. So you go out to these protests and it's huge masses of people, and a lot of them are grandparents. And they say, I'm here because of my grandkids. I'm here because my children all left this country and no one's left to fight but me. And they're really showing a lot of bravery because people are getting hurt at these things. And it's not just the clashes after the protest. People are getting slammed with tear gas. People are having rocks thrown at them. Just yesterday, a 20-year-old died because he was hit with a tear gas canister in the face. And after the main protests are over, you get these clashes between the younger people and the police. And those have turned deadly. But you also will have people eating at a nice restaurant right nearby, or people eating ice cream as these clashes unfold. So people are getting very numb to the violence, and they're going out every day.
Has the circumstances of Venezuela gone to the point where, you know, Venezuela's proud history has in a sense been erased, and we've gone back to some square one moment that it's hard to see how you build back from here, Hannah?
Yes. Venezuela was kind of an inspiration for a lot of people on the left under Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez came in. Venezuela was a very unequal society. The poor had really been shut out of the political discourse. And he brought the poor in, and he erased a lot of poverty. He brought education to the slums and medical care to the slums. And people really did have a better standard of living for a while. And all those gains have now been totally rolled back. People are hungrier than they were before Chavez. They're poorer. Their lives are much harder. So it was kind of this shining example that's now been tarnished in a lot of people's minds.
What's it like to leave Venezuela and to go back? I mean, physically, what does it feel like to have this kind of weight lifted of all this unrest around you?
It's so bizarre. So I am out of the country for just a couple days, and I'm going back in tomorrow. I'm going to try to bring gas masks and other supplies down. And you leave the country and you don't even realize how much pressure there is there until you get to, you know, the Bogota airport or the Miami airport. And it's like a weight is just lifted. This time I've been struck by how people are smiling in the streets. There's just this kind of sense of happiness and optimism that you don't see anymore in Venezuela. It's gotten so grim down there. And you get used to it. And I think that's also something that we're seeing with the protests. People are so used to violence. 60 people a day are murdered in Venezuela, and it's a small country. So you just get numb to the violence and kind of numb to the crisis. And then you go out and take these big risks like protesters are doing every day.
And you're going back into it. What's that feeling?
Well, you kind of have to gird yourself when you go back into Caracas. You fly in and it's already pretty bleak. The airport is always deserted. People won't stand outside anymore because some people have been killed and robbed just leaving the international airport. So everyone's kind of huddled inside. And no taxis want to take you if it's dark out because the highways have gotten too dangerous at night. But you know, local media can't do the job the way that us foreign correspondents can. They are really subject to censorship and to retaliation by the government and by government supporters. So we can sometimes take risks that for them could be deadly. For us, the worst that can happen really is we'll get deported or maybe we'll get detained, but we'll always be let go. So you do feel a sense of responsibility as a foreign correspondent down there.
Finally, Hannah, has it concerned you at all the extent to which Venezuela is really below the radar in the news coverage here in the United States as you've been on your break?
I'm always surprised. When you're in Caracas, when you're in Venezuela, you feel like it's the center of the world. It's just so extreme, and people are fighting so hard for a change right now. And, you know, it's only 3 hours away from the U.S. It's very close. And there are a lot of economic ties. Venezuela sells a lot of oil to the U.S., and there are also a lot of cultural ties. But with everything happening in the world, I think it's hard for people to keep paying attention to Venezuela because the crisis has been going on for so long. And it keeps getting worse, but it's like already terrible. So when basically an unsustainable situation gets incrementally worse, I think it's hard for people to keep their eyes on it. And that's another thing that's driving the protests. People are saying we need to do something to get the world's attention here. And if it means shutting down the capital city every day for a month, we're going to do it.
Hannah Dreyer, Venezuela correspondent for the Associated Press. Thanks so much, Hannah.
Good talking with you.
There's an Esso gas station in Sylvan Lake, Alberta, Canada, that, in fact, has nothing to do with the Curious band called Sylvan Esso. You've probably heard them in this AT&T commercial in heavy rotation right now, but mostly they are a successful, jolly, musical bus of fans who can hum every tune from the fusion, folk, pop, the categories are kind of meaningless to your band, and who can't get enough of Amelia Meath and Nick Sanborn. The duo says their name actually comes from the video game Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery, but this vocal and synthesizer-driven husband and wife team are the first to admit their musical joy is plain old pop, more Sonny and Cher than Depeche Mode.
The part that I love about it is that we make each other better, or we're larger than the sum of our parts.
I'm a huge fan of hers. Like, I loved Mountain Man. I love what she writes on her own. And so I think when I hear something that she's written, what I want to do is create something around it that shows other people what I love about it. Maybe like to kind of contextualize it the way I see it. And I think she kind of does the same thing for me.
Your band was Mountain Man. I mean, were you originally thinking, I'll just be like kind of a folk singer sort of?
Not really.
Thing? No.
I always wanted to make pop songs.
Really?
Yeah, that was my goal. Or I grew up listening to pop music.
Was there an instrument of you, or was it your voice?
It was always my voice. I mean, like, one, I'm really dyslexic, so the idea of learning any instrument deeper than getting the notes that I want out of it is really, really daunting to me.
I've never heard that excuse. You know, I can't. I wish I'd taken up an instrument, but I'm too dyslexic. I've never heard that forever.
It's a horror. Yeah, they're all excuses.
Well, also, here's the thing. Like, I don't have a great voice. I don't have a great singing voice. I think if you have a great singing voice, you're like, oh, I can make music now. Whereas the rest of us trolls in our parents' basements were, you know, sitting there being like, well, I can't sing. I have to figure out something else I can do. So I better pour 10,000 hours into this guitar, you know?
So you're like the guitarist become the keyboard DJ kind of thing?
I played bass. Bass is probably my main instrument. I played that in jazz band in high school. I played saxophone. But I was always kind of more interested in composition. I went to college for composition.
Oh, how impressive.
I did. Well, I dropped out, so, you know.
So he dropped out, that impressed you, right? Let's hear, because your mother is a radio producer, I happen to know. Let's hear the song Radio. Pop song, don't you want to sing along? Say it to the radio. I feel like it's all about my career.
We have this joke that people always want to come up to you and tell you what your songs are about, and your songs are about them, which is great.
Great. Stein, I feel like a fanboy.
No, it's... Could you slide my wrist, please? Yeah, totally.
What is your most pop tune these days on this album? What would you say is your most, you know, in the old days, with a bullet, rise to number one?
Well, it's tough because that last song you played, Radio, is kind of about the idea of having one of those.
Yeah, and that's the most straight-ahead one that we have.
Well, on purpose, obviously, but yeah. I mean, I think Die Young is I think that's a pretty great song.
That's
true.
I was gonna die young. Yeah, Die Young is like a real, it's just simply a love song, which is one of the first love songs I've ever really written that's just about that.
Let's hear Kick.
Right. Kick, Jump, Twist.
Give me a little preamble.
Kick, Jump, Twist is just about practicing for all of the attention you're going to eventually get. And like, you know, when you're a kid and you're like practicing being a human being, and then that translates into practicing preparing to be famous, whether or not that actually happens.
My 15-year-old daughter does that.
Right? Yeah. A lot of time spent in front of the mirror. A lot of singing into hairbrushes.
I did not do much of that at all. And my staff can attest to that. I need a hairbrush. That's for sure. All right, let's hear it. But what if
They call you, then you go away. The highway, an airport, every day. You don't care, you're moving anyway. Every day, kick, don't twist. Kick, don't twist.
That's so great. You achieved so much with so, I mean, bigger than the sum of your parts. I mean, you, it's such a vast canvas you make with so little.
Thank you very much.
Who do you want to cover you? Who would you love to have cover you?
You know, I have a lot of opinions about covers in general. I think there are some songs you shouldn't be allowed to cover. I don't know if I've never thought of anybody else covering our songs.
But I always think of who we'd want to cover.
Yeah, it's true. But I have a cut and fast rule that you can't cover the Beatles or Prince or Bowie. And everyone's covering Bowie right now. And I think
that's
wrong.
Well, and Prince, yeah.
But most people don't go for Prince because Prince is so hard.
Yeah, the range.
You know? Yeah, the range and also the spirit. I think you should only cover a song if you think that there was like a section of it that wasn't seen through to fruition in the original song.
Mm. So you have to add something to the song if you're covering it.
I think so.
Did Hendrix add something to Watchtower?
Yes.
Definitely.
Still love the John Wesley Harding version.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But I think he did.
Mm-hmm. And Bruce Hornsby added something new to his cover of Little Wing.
Well, and you
that
know,
is true.
We've
is
talked
true.
About this before, but that Fiona Apple cover
of Across the
Across
Universe.
Breaks the
your
rule.
Rule.
Yeah, that's the only
and
one.
And that's a fantastic cover.
Mm-hmm.
Things you need to do on your next album? Things you're dying to do? Next stage?
I just want to get better. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a new goal for me, is trying to figure out how to improve now that we've done it. I'd like to start, instead of like proving the fact that I could do it, now getting better. That's something that Meryl Garbus from Toon Yards told me about. I hadn't realized it until our first record. She was like, you're always doing well if you're learning. And I realized that I hadn't learned anything.
You're just trying to prove it.
You're
proving that you could do it.
Fighting so hard.
Yeah.
And now that I feel like we've gotten far along the fight, that I can now start learning again.
That's Amelia Meath and Nick Sanborn of Sylvan Esso. Their second album, What Now, is out on Friday.
I'm washing with all my friends in the kitchen, drying dishes.
President Trump has had almost 100 days in office now. How important is that 100 days measure, and how's he doing?
Hi, my name is Damani. I'm calling from Brooklyn. And the first 100 days of the presidency is extremely important, as it is a way for we the people to gauge the efficiency, dedication, and commitment to the campaign promises that we've heard throughout the last 18 months.
Greg from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. I think the president's doing just a fine job. I've told my girls, my son, that they're so blessed to have a president this strong and this early in their life, that he will go down as probably the greatest president of our lifetime. I thought Reagan was a good one, but Trump, it will be a doer.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway. Donald Trump took office. The Takeaway and PRI have been asking the president one question every day as part of our 100 Questions in 100 Days project. Go to the hashtag 100Days100Qs and visit PRI.org/100Questions to see what we've asked the president. Thanks so much. I'm John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway.
To be swallowed, let it last, let it last, let it last, let it last.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Moo, offering print products with features like Printfinity, a technology that gives the ability to print a different image on every business card. Learn more at Moo.com. And by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.